The Guardian.
In October of this year, a team from Eindhoven University of Technology in the Netherlands were awarded a grant of 2.9 million euros to develop a working prototype of an artificial womb for use in the clinic. The hope is an artificial womb could allow premature babies to continue to develop as they would in a real womb and improve their chance of survival. At the moment, babies born at 22 weeks have a survival rate of around 10% or so, but 2 weeks later, that jumps to about 60%. The Dutch team hope to have their artificial womb ready for use in clinic in 5 years, but they aren't the first to work on such technology. Among other attempts, in 2017, a team based in Philadelphia created an artificial womb that they called the BioBag and showed it could sustain lambs delivered prematurely. But some argue that these researchers are getting a bit ahead of themselves, as there's still so much we don't know about the complex processes involved in premature birth.
To deliver very early, something has to have gone wrong before birth. And so although we often think of the baby as acquiring problems after birth, that's just what we see.
I'm Nicola Davis, and this week we'll be looking at the potential of these artificial womb systems and asking what needs to be done before we see them in the clinic. That includes taking on some pretty knotty questions about the potential inhabitants of these artificial wombs.
So I've called it a gestateling. So it's a human being undergoing the process of creation of gestation, just extra uterine. And I think that makes it unique and means that there are interesting questions to ask about it.
All coming up on Science Weekly.
Yeah, good to go.
Right.
Great. So, Neil, I'm going to ask you...
Before we get on to the potential of artificial wombs, I wanted to get a sense of how neonatal units currently handle babies born prematurely.
My name is Neil Marlow. I'm a professor of neonatal medicine at University College London, and I lead a research team into the long-term effects of premature birth.
So, Neil, to start off, you're a consultant specialising in neonatal care. Can you talk me through what you see in your day-to-day job? You know, how early are these babies being born, and what's the kind of situation that you're facing?
I think over the last 30 years, we've seen an immense change in the population of babies who go to neonatal care. We now have huge numbers of extremely immature babies, which we're looking after, and they're surviving, and they're growing up. And it has made a huge difference to what we do and our understanding of the physiology and the things that can go wrong following preterm birth. So one of the things that I've done over the years is to spend my life looking at what happens to children after they go home. And we do know that a significant proportion of babies who are born, say, under 26 weeks will have disabilities. But it's not the majority. But amongst the remainder, there are some patterns of problems that we see that still cause us concern. And some of those patterns are due to being born early. And some of those patterns are down to the things that we have to do to keep babies alive. When you're born at very low gestational ages, you're in the middle of a really rapid phase of development. And during that period, tissues signaling from cell to cell and from organ to organ are really important in the way the body is put together. And when you're born early, you're removed from that environment. And although we're getting better at providing an environment for those babies to grow up in, we're still not there yet. There's still many things we can do.
How young are the babies, or how premature are the babies that you see now? You said you've seen them getting younger and younger, that you're able to keep alive and to allow them to grow and develop. So how young are we talking now? How viable?
Well, you may have seen in the newspaper, a rival the other week, the British Association of Perinatal Medicine have just been reviewing the guidelines for looking after babies at very low gestations. And there's no doubt that at 23 and 24 weeks, survival is now double what it was 10 years ago. And for the first time, those babies who have active interventionist care from the very beginning and are born at 22 weeks, a significant proportion are surviving. So we have to think very hard about the ethics of what we're doing, because the rate of disability, for example, goes up quite substantially as the more immature you are. But also we have to think about what parents and families want as the child's growing up. And I think one of the biggest differences we see in care now to what we saw before is that families are involved in the child's care and involved very closely in the decisions that we make about their babies.
Can you tell me a bit about the emotional impact of premature birth on the parents?
Being a parent of a baby born at 23 or 24 weeks gestation is challenging because something has gone wrong in the pregnancy. And to get to the stage where the baby's born was not a place that they had really envisaged when they embarked on the pregnancy. So it's a surprise, it's a stress, and it's deeply worrying for parents, particularly when they begin to understand some of the challenges that their baby is likely to face as he grows up in the neonatal unit and subsequently further on. So parents are stressed very much by this process, and that leads to challenges in terms of post-traumatic stress, which is more common amongst families of very mature infants, and also the feeling that their baby is somehow more vulnerable than other infants as it grows up and therefore needs more protection, which may or may not be true.
As Neil alludes to, complications from preterm births can be complex, as the development of organs and bodily systems are disrupted. This can lead to problems with the lungs, which are filled with fluid in the mother's womb, the eyes, and, crucially, the brain. I asked Neil whether it was something about being outside of the womb that can lead to this.
There are two things going on. The first is that to deliver very early, something has to have gone wrong before birth. And so although we often think of the baby as acquiring problems after birth, that's just what we see. And we do not understand, to a large extent, the problems that are going on before birth. And they can revolve around two particular issues. One is the presence of infection, as often you will find that the membranes surrounding the baby will rupture early, and that allows in infection into the womb, and that prompts premature labour. But it also puts bacteria and other infectious agents into the baby and starts an inflammatory process which may exacerbate things. And the fact that you've got those processes going on may switch some of the developmental processes. The second thing that we see quite often is babies fail to grow particularly well before birth. And we often are in a dilemma as to whether to deliver a baby who's clearly not growing very well and get him out of what's an environment where he's not getting enough food, perhaps not getting enough oxygen to develop properly, and then to run the gauntlet of trying to do it after birth. And in both of those situations, you've got a baby who is coming out with already, if you like, handicapped by what's gone before. These developmental processes are very complex. There are many hormones that contribute to this. And for example, one of the things we're trying to do at the moment is to replace one of the growth factors that we see in that is low in very premature babies and put it up to normal levels to see if we can actually improve the long-term growth and reduce some of the problems that we see amongst babies, particularly in the lungs, in the eyes, and in the brain.
When we compare the environment in the womb to the environment that you produce for these babies when they're born prematurely, I mean, they seem quite different. You know, in the womb, you're receiving all of your nutrients and oxygen through the umbilical cord from the placenta. Obviously, that's not what's going on in your neonatal unit. Can you talk me through some of those differences and what the implications of those differences are?
Well, the implications are for every system. If we take the lungs, for example, the lungs are not providing exchange of gas. They're not allowing oxygen to come into the body before birth, but afterwards the baby is dependent upon it. So the lung development has to change immediately. And we know that happens over a relatively short period of time, but that has a cost. And the cost is that some of the developmental processes that you would normally see going on actually slow down. And that, I think, is probably what we see in most of the other organ systems. If we think a little bit about eye development, for example, why am I talking about eyes? But the eye is a real problem in extremely preterm babies, because when a baby is born at 24 weeks, the blood vessels that supply the retina, the bit that we see with at the back of the eye, have not developed onto the surface of the retina. That has to happen over the next 10, 12 weeks. And that process is interfered with by having too much oxygen, which of course may happen if we give the baby oxygen, but actually letting the baby breathe air may be giving it too much oxygen, because before birth the baby is relatively low in oxygen levels. And interference with those blood vessels can then cause other problems, which lead to us having to do something about it to prevent blindness. And we do that very successfully now, and we know what the process is, but we need to get in at the beginning so that we're not having to give treatments to stop disease processes that we see progressing.
The chances of survival for premature babies have improved dramatically in recent years, but there is more to do, and that's where the artificial womb might come in. In a 2017 study published in Nature Communications, a team based in the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia showed how their system, dubbed the BioBag, was able to keep alive lambs delivered by cesarean section at the equivalent of 23 to 24 weeks in a human pregnancy. We'll include a link to my colleague Hannah Devlin's reporting on the study, which includes pictures of this BioBag in action. Essentially, it was a see-through bag in which the tiny pink lambs were placed for up to 4 weeks. The sterile, temperature-controlled environment of the bag was designed to mimic the womb, with a system featuring a substitute for amniotic fluid and an opening for the umbilical cord, which allowed the delivery of oxygen and nutrients to the lamb. If you take a look at those images, you'll see that over time, those naked-looking lambs grew bigger and even developed a fluffy white wool coat. Tests on these animals showed their lung function and brain growth seemed to match that of lambs delivered from a ewe at the same point in gestation. We reached out to members of the team behind the study to invite them to join the podcast and talk about their work, but they were unavailable and did not reply to questions by email in time for our recording. I asked Neil what he made of the idea of an artificial womb.
In some ways, they're fabulous. I mean, having the resources to be able to do it is just an incredible privilege. And that we will learn so much about early development through these experiments, which is what they are. The other problem is really what I've been saying before, that something has happened that a baby needs to deliver early. And those processes are ongoing at birth. And of course, having a baby in an artificial womb doesn't stop those processes. And so you have to deal with those processes as well. And so there are two issues, really. One is, can we get the baby to grow in a fluid environment, fed through the umbilicus? And secondly, can we reduce the effect of the reasons that the baby has been born early? And that's where the research falls down a bit, because in practical terms, in the laboratory, we're taking an animal and delivering it artificially, prematurely, when there isn't an ongoing process there.
Yes, I see what you mean. Often one thinks of a premature baby as being just a healthy baby that happens to have been born early, as opposed to there being some problem which has triggered that early
That's
birth.
Absolutely correct. And one of the miracles of modern medicine is that a baby can be born at 23 weeks and can develop in the neonatal unit, in an incubator, you know, surrounded by all the noise and the other things that he wouldn't normally be exposed to, or she wouldn't be exposed to in the womb, separate from them, their parents, and particularly the mother, And then do so well afterwards. I think that is a miracle. And the challenge for us is to make sure that when we're trying to improve our intensive care, that actually by doing that, we're addressing these issues.
When we reached out to the team at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, we put Neil's criticism to them. But at the time of our recording, they hadn't responded. We also hoped to ask them whether this biobag approach is any closer to being used in humans. In Hannah's piece for The Guardian, the team predicted that humans could be incubated in the system within 3 years in a clinical trial, and that was in 2017. So the technology is advancing, and the potential for humans at least appears to be on the horizon. In the second half of the show, we'll be exploring what this might mean in terms of ethical and legal implications. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Science Weekly. Before the break, we heard from Neil Marlowe about some of the complications linked to premature birth, and also the advances in the neonatal clinics that mean survival rates are improving. We also heard about how artificial wombs might be the next development in neonatal care, albeit with remaining technical challenges. But it's not just the technology that researchers are looking at.
My name is Elizabeth Chloe Romanis. I'm a PhD candidate in law and bioethics at the University of Manchester. People tend to call me Chloe.
So this isn't something that is just theoretical. People are actually trying to do this. How much of a change in technology is this? How exciting, how new an idea is this, creating an artificial womb?
I think that's a really interesting question, because there's certainly been a trend in the bioethical literature to claim that artificial wombs are almost a partial reality because of how successful neonatal intensive care has been at saving the lives of neonates born incredibly premature. However, I've tried to challenge this trend because I think that there is a conceptual distinction between technology that helps neonates to sustain themselves by providing mechanical ventilation and technology like the artificial womb, which is something that instead of helping a neonate to sort of perform its own life functions, is instead continuing to create it and enabling the continued gestation of the human entity before birth.
So in a way, the distinction you're drawing is between sort of something that really is mimicking the womb and allowing the baby to develop as it would in the womb, so in a fluid environment and, you know, with oxygen coming through an umbilical cord, not through its lungs, versus what we have now, which is very much about using things that don't look a lot like biology to try to keep the baby going. Is that what you mean?
Absolutely. I think what's really important about the artificial womb prototypes is that they don't just mimic like the uterine environment, but they mimic the function of the placenta. So it is things like the premature human being remains in an amniotic type fluid and receives oxygen that way, rather than the lungs having to clear and for them to draw breath in order to get oxygen.
So obviously there have been some pretty big technical challenges in trying to create these kinds of systems. But in terms of the implications of them, that gets a little bit knotty too. What are some of the key legal and ethical challenges that occur when you move from the one type of system to an artificial womb type of system?
The first challenge that I think is actually overlooked the most is how you even make that transition. So how do we go from the technology we already know works in some circumstances, but has some limitations in terms of how well it can work? So for example, we know that the technology only works beyond a certain level of lung maturation. And also we know that there are lots of complications associated with neonatal intensive care. But we also know that those technologies can work and they can help premature babies to survive. So how do we ethically justify using artificial womb technology, which we only know works conceptually and potentially on lamb models? How do we justify using that technology in place of technology that already works?
So it sounds a bit as though you're saying the issue here is that in the first cases this has to be used. It's a bit of an experiment.
Absolutely. I think it is medical research as opposed to innovative therapy. And that's quite a thorny issue in healthcare generally, is where is something so new that we have to regulate it like an experiment and provide lots of protections for the subjects of that experiment? And where is it just an innovative therapy that's just a slight extension of stuff that already exists that we might use in situations of a last resort? And I think this is clearly an instance of medical research, and that has its own legal and ethical parameters that need to be carefully garnered in this particular arena.
Presumably at some point the neonatal care we have now was new, you know, incubators were new. So is this something which has been negotiated before and therefore could be negotiated again?
Absolutely. I mean, that's a really interesting question, but the neonatal incubator in its inception has been around for quite a long time. So the legal and ethical frameworks we use to think about healthcare ethics are very different now. But that said, I do think that the research is ethically justifiable for similar sorts of reasons. So it is quite likely that if this technology were able to work, that it would produce better outcomes for the 15 million premature babies born every year worldwide. And it also might potentially save the lives of pregnant people. And so those are really good ethical justifications for research trials. It's just that we would have to make sure that when doing them, we paid proper attention to the kinds of protections that subjects in a trial would need.
Another question Chloe has been delving into is exactly how we should define the potential inhabitants of these artificial wombs.
I have argued that the subject of an artificial womb is a unique human entity that we've never seen before. So it shares some ontological features with a fetus because it hasn't undergone the major biological adaptations in birth. For example, fluid hasn't drained from the lungs, the digestive system hasn't activated, and so on. So it seems really similar to a fetus. However, it also seems like a neonate because it's extra uterine. So there's no pregnant person maintaining its gestation, its growth. So I've called it a gestateling, and I've argued that it's something in the middle. So it's a human being undergoing the process of creation of gestation, just extra uterine. And I think that makes it unique and means that there are interesting questions to ask about it. So because it's separate from a fetus and a neonate, how do we treat it? It shares certain functions with both. Does that mean we have to treat it more like one or the other? And in particular, what I'm really interested in is the fact that I don't think this particular human entity, a gestateling, has undergone the important adaptations for life, at which point I think that it hasn't completed the process of birth. And that's legally really interesting.
Not everyone agrees. So some, including the philosopher Dr. Nick Colgrove, have said that basically what you call gestatelings are just another type of newborn, in the same way that you have premature babies and you have babies born at full term. In a sense, I suppose you could say that these babies are born and then put back into an artificial womb. It's not like they go seamlessly from a womb into a biological womb. So they've gone through that transition at least at some point. So what do you make of that? Is this just a very contentious area?
I mean, it is really contentious. It's great that there is actually so much debate coming off my first paper about whether this is birth or not. But I don't agree with that conception, mostly because I think birth, as truly defined, isn't just a matter of location. It's a matter of the process of gestation ending. So it's about a neonate ending that process of being created and coming into the world as they will be, right? And I think that that process of gestation hasn't ended when something is transferred from a pregnancy into an artificial womb for two major reasons. The first is just that those biological adaptations are never made. So, for example, in the current animal studies, the subjects are provided with a drug that stops the lung from draining, and then, you know, that they're transferred, which effectively means they don't do the kinds of things that happen when a newborn is born. Those processes just aren't complete, physiologically and physically. Secondly, I think what's really meaningful about the process of birth is it's relational, right? So once you're born into existence, there are certain types of interactions you can have with other human beings. So you can be touched and all sorts of things. Those processes happen even in the neonatal intensive care. There's that certain type of interaction that happens between premature babies and their parent or parents. That can't happen in the artificial womb. Everything sensory is still contained in the artificial womb. So the neonate isn't experiencing or interacting with the world if they're in an artificial womb. So I don't think they count as a newborn.
Are you saying that you disagree with the WHO definition of a live birth? I mean, they say that it's the complete expulsion or extraction from its mother, irrespective of the duration of the pregnancy.
Yeah, but that particular definition, I just don't think a gestating meets it, because it says live birth. And the WHO defines a live birth as clear, independent signs of existence in that particular definition. And I just don't think those are evident. It's obviously biologically alive when it's in an artificial womb, but it's not sustaining itself, and it's still undergoing the process of creation, at which point it just doesn't satisfy that criteria.
So we've got this knotty issue of whether a gestating, as you call it, is a fetus, is it a baby, or is it, you know, as you say, sort of something else. What does this mean in terms of sort of legal protections?
I think what we can definitely say is that the current mechanism for affording legal protections doesn't work, because it's not clear that a gestating is born alive within the definitions currently afforded in the law. So at the moment, the Births and Deaths Registration Act requires that a newborn either breathe or demonstrate any other signs of life. A gestating obviously doesn't breathe because of the system it's encased in. And I've argued it doesn't really demonstrate any other exertive signs of life, at which point it might not satisfy that definition. I highlight this problem because I think it demonstrates the possibility of human beings existing ex utero in a unique category, and we need to have real meaningful discussion about what protections we afford to human beings that are still in the process of being created that exist ex utero. Now, those protections might be similar to a fetus or similar to a newborn, but that's something we need to engage in a discussion about.
As Chloe points out, this technology throws up big ethical quandaries that we might have to eventually grapple with. But Neil Marlow believes that artificial womb technology is still a long way away from being used in the clinic.
I see artificial womb technology as something that we have yet to understand. And understanding its place in our care is not yet there. You might think that you should be using it for babies who would benefit from a period in an artificial womb whilst something else was done, for example, a surgical procedure to put something right. And one could perhaps envisage an argument for that. But I think we have a huge distance to go before we're able to say this is a way in which I can get out of having to provide, you know, skin-to-skin intensive care for a baby of 22 weeks.
But just because it's a long way off doesn't mean we shouldn't start thinking about it now. At least that's what Chloe thinks.
This is something I have argued quite frequently for a couple of reasons. I think the first is just ethico-legal issues involved when we're talking about reproductive technologies are so complicated, and there are lots of nuances and potential implications. And I think we can only engage properly and thoroughly and have really reasoned discussions about these kinds of issues if we engage with them now, when they're sort of speculative, rather than waiting until the technology is here and having our reactions to it either motivated by fear and disgust or potentially a dangerous overenthusiasm. I also think, and this is just from my perspective as an academic, but I think it's really interesting to use examples of technologies on the horizon as just imaginaries for possibilities that we can use to examine the current law. So even if artificial wombs probably won't be available for a long time, it's still really worth examining the way that we think about birth, how we regulate pregnancy, just exposing some of the flaws in our current legislation, just because I think we can learn a lot from that exercise.
Special thanks this week to Chloe Romanis and Neil Marlowe for joining me. We'll include links to Chloe's work, as well as Guardian articles on the topic of artificial wombs, in this episode's description at theguardian.com.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.